Feel the pulse of the city. Feel the beat of the drum. Feel the bass blow your hair. In Las Vegas, live music delivers much more than sound. It's where music comes alive. With artists like Megan Thee Stallion, Maroon 5, Carrie Underwood, Shania Twain, Babyface, Lionel Richie, and many more. Every show is a playground for your senses. See the full summer lineup at visitlasvegas.com.
Cam found out that group chats between different phones aren't private.
Or encrypted,
thank you. We only text in code.
Yes, which I created. I created a code.
Yes. Which can be a little annoying.
Wait, was that your attempt at the code?
You already forgot the code, didn't you?
I should have written it down.
The place to safely send messages between different devices. WhatsApp. Message privately with everyone.
Rack up the deals on everything summer at Nordstrom Rack and get brands you love up to 60% off. Vince, Kate Spade New York, Steve Madden, Madewell, Nike, and more. Great brands, great prices every day at Nordstrom Rack. Just in dresses, tops, shorts, sandals, sneakers, denim, luxury bags, and sunglasses. Rack up the deals today and save up to 60% on summer at your Nordstrom Rack store.
Do you know about all the musical genres that were created by Black musicians? Like jazz, rock and roll, and folk music, to name a few. This Black Music Month, State Farm is celebrating the cultural impact and influence of music created and inspired by Black innovators. Next time you're enjoying a song, trace it back to its origins and see for yourself. Check out the Black Music Forever station on Pandora, brought to you by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Welcome back to the UFO Rabbit Hole podcast. I'm your host, Kelly Chase. The podcast is still on hiatus as I work with the Ontocalypse team to wrap up production on our upcoming docuseries, The Beyond, UFOs and a New Reality. But while I'm away, I've teamed up with J. Christopher King to bring you guys a series of unreleased talks from the phenomenal Inquiry into Anomalous Experience and the Phenomenon conferences. In this talk, we hear from Joshua Cutchin. Josh is a researcher and author of several books, including Thieves in the Night, A Brief History of Supernatural Child Abductions, and Ecology of Souls, A New Mythology of Death and the Paranormal. In the traditions of great works like Jacques Vallée's Passport to Magonia, Cutchin's work explores the profound connections between folklore and myths from around the world and modern reports of contact with UFOs and non-human intelligences. And in this talk from the December 2023 conference, he dives into the themes that emerge in accounts of all of these phenomena that indicate that they all are deeply tied to the mysteries of death, the soul, and what lies beyond the veil. Before we begin, I should mention that this episode is brought to you by The Experiencer Group. The Experiencer Group is a private online community dedicated to support, curiosity, and community for people who've had anomalous events of all kinds. They hold regular support meetings for people who are processing anomalous experiences, book clubs, special guest speaker presentations, and more. You can learn more and sign up at tegmembers.com. The link is in the episode description. All right, let's get to it. Here's Jay introducing Joshua Cutchin.
All right. Hey, everybody. Hey, everybody. Shh. Shut up. Be quiet. Welcome. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome to an inquiry into anomalous experiences and the phenomenon, fall 2023. My name is J. Christopher King. Thank you so much for joining us here today. Our first speaker today, researcher and author of as many as eight books is how he put it earlier. As many as eight books. Nine if you count a book that's just appendices for the wonderful Ecology of the Souls. There's a new book. Josh wrote his first fiction novel, right? Your first novel. It's called Them Old Ways Never Die. Is that right? There we go. Yeah. All right. I got it. I nailed it. All right. So please welcome to the stage the amazing, the brilliant Joshua Cutchin.
Good morning. This has something to do with what we call death. That's a hell of a way to start a Saturday morning, isn't it? This has something to do with what we call death. These are the words that Whitley Strieber found scrawled in his wife's handwriting across a yellow notepad. Anne was tasked with reading all the correspondence sent to Whitley in the wake of his 1987 bestseller, Communion, and recorded her observations along the way, including this memorable insight. Ever since I heard it, this quote has haunted me. But as it turns out, I was moving towards this possibility long before I ever realized it. My initial entry point into the UFO phenomenon was examining the similarities between fairy folklore and encounters with humanoids, which I still find quite fascinating. The correspondences seem to me undeniable, if they're true. Jacques Vallée's landmark 1969 work, Passport to Magonia, proved, again, to me at least, that beyond a shadow of a doubt, there is some sort of connection between older fairy folklore from across the world and the modern UFO contact experience. Forgive me, I'm a bit old-fashioned, so I'll be using UFO and even flying saucer alongside UAP today. However, with all due respect to that book, I wouldn't be here without Dr. Jacques Vallée's work. I don't think even Dr. Vallée realized how deep those connections run. Over the course of my research, I've found that nearly every aspect of fairy folklore has a corollary in the UFO contact experience. The inverse seems to be true as well, even down to the presence of implants in what was once called the fairy blast. But I, too, had no inkling of the profundity behind these connections. Something was left on the table, something that Anne Strieber so keenly observed. The connection to death. It was there all along, staring me in the face. For example, most cultures, especially prior to the rise of theosophy in the late 19th century, associated fairies with the human dead, either that we become them or that they are stewards of the transition from this life into the next. This, alongside Anne's quote and the persistence of the human dead appearing in UFO contact, a rarely discussed but persistent subject, led me to embark on a journey of exploration into the connections between death and UFOs. The result was one book split into two volumes totaling over 260,000 words, and I barely scratched the surface. Many of these similarities had already been noted. As mentioned, Vallée compared UFO occupants to fairies and spirits, while Kenneth Ring compared alien abductions to near-death experiences in the 1990s, and Eddie Bullard compared them to shamanic initiations even before that. What my work, Ecology of Souls, hopefully accomplishes is putting these disparate contact modalities in dialogue with one another. To me, the gestalt seems to suggest that our final transition, death itself, undergirds most, if not all, paranormal phenomena, including UAP. I realize that this idea might not be palatable to some of you. Little about my work, perhaps with the exception of my 2016 book, The Brimstone Deceit, is scientific. Instead, my perspective is primarily driven by the humanities, especially comparative folklore. My goal is not necessarily to argue for solutions to these mysteries, but to encourage the examination of the broader UAP phenomenon through this lens, with the hope of leading to new avenues of inquiry. To simply ask the question, what if the intelligence behind UAP comes from places we would never imagine? The biggest objection to proposing a connection between UFOs and the dead comes in the form of reductionism, that UAP must be physical objects since they clearly generate physical effects. I see this as a flaw of first-order thinking. Consider instead the elegant summary of this tension from psychonaut-turned-philosopher Terence McKenna. Terence said, do I do the Terry voice? This is, okay, here we go.
This is an important point to make, which the flying saucer people are forever misunderstanding. Saying that the flying saucer is a psychic object does not mean that it is not a physical object. The realm of the psychic and the realm of the physical meet in a strange kind of never-never land that we have yet to create the intellectual tools to explore.
Thank you. With apologies. In short, our consensus conceptualization of physical versus non-physical represents, in my mind, a false dichotomy. The UFO is both. It is physical and psychic. Perhaps it's a bit like ourselves. Humans are embedded in the physical realm with a component of the psychic. Maybe the UFO is embedded in the psychic with an important aspect that is physical. I would take this a step further and argue that the UFO blends the boundaries between fact and fiction, between reality and storytelling, but that's a topic for another time. For those of you struggling with this idea, because I know that I did, consider that most fringe topics embody this same contradiction. Ghosts, if they exist, are non-physical, yet clearly seem to interact with the environment, from slamming doors to vocalizing, and even in the earliest days of parapsychological research, leaving footprints in talcum powder. The work of researchers like Dean Radin indicates that our minds, our non-physical, psychical component, can influence the outside world of shared consensus reality. Stigmata appears on the hands of the Christian devout, and injuries sometimes manifest after violent dreams, somehow. At the risk of generating laughter, I don't know how receptive this crowd is to this particular topic, this seems to be what lies at the heart of the Bigfoot phenomenon as well. A phenomenon that displays all the hallmarks of the physical, from footprints to hairs and even droppings, yet remains ever elusive and, inevitably, linked to far stranger things. If this still feels a bit too peculiar, it's okay with me if you call the afterlife another dimension. After all, it probably is, and parapsychologists arrived at this conclusion long ago. Consider this lovely exchange between author Brad Steiger and renowned parapsychologist Hans Holzer. Holzer declared, "I have always said that these so-called ETs are from the spirit world," to which Steiger interjected, "or other dimensions." Holzer replied with a shrug, "And what may be the difference?" As fascinated as I am by UFO occupants, today's discussion focuses primarily on the UAP themselves and what their forms might suggest about their connection to death. Given our time constraints, we'll have to be brief and breezy, but rest assured that for every claim, there are dozens of well-cited examples across both volumes of Ecology of Souls. I may not be interpreting the data accurately or without bias, but the data is there. Finally, before we start, another word of caution. I'm unsure how literally these comparisons should be taken, if at all, but I do strongly feel that the comparisons are worth making. To grossly overgeneralize, UAP can be divided into two categories, lights and structured craft. We'll deal with the latter in a bit, but in the meantime, the first interpretation I would like to suggest is perhaps the strangest, that the lights might represent nothing less than human souls. Many have played with this idea in the past. Although not speaking directly about lights in the sky, Carl Jung suggested that the circular shape of the flying saucer, seen so often in the 1950s, might symbolize the mandala, a symbol of totality he compared at length to the human soul. More recently, Dr. Jeffrey Kripal has become fond of saying, "Please recognize that when we can only speak of these glowing presences as threats in the sky, we might as well be trying to shoot down souls." Good luck with that. It's a radical idea, but represents far more than mere academic pontification. A diverse subset of indigenous beliefs from every inhabited continent keeps returning to the same claim, sometimes intuitive but often observed firsthand, that the human soul can appear as a luminous orb of light, released at the moment of death. This notion also appears in Judeo-Christian and Eastern religions, as well as spiritualist and New Age practices. The belief is almost universal, a claim I do not make lightly. Thus, we have an initial possibility that the lights are us. But there are other ways, besides death, to release this inner light. From out-of-body experiences to astral travel to remote viewing, there seem to be techniques by which human consciousness can be liberated from the physical. Perhaps lights in the sky represent not the human dead, but human souls separated from their living bodies, observed by third parties. In his 1962 book, Flying Saucers and Spacemen, American occultist John Manasse proposed this exact possibility. He wrote, A clear and strong thought can be projected and be sent many thousands of miles away and be materialized at its place of destination and under proper conditions, seen by men. This is the truth about UFOs, commonly known as flying saucers, spaceships, and spacemen. Dr. Vallee, upon reading Manasseh's book, wondered whether or not earthbound entities or spirits produce images of flying saucers, although he remained noncommittal on this possibility. Is it coincidental, then, that so many of these sightings occur at night, the time when a vast majority of us fall into a collective altered state of consciousness, sleep? It's worth noting that, if we entertain this possibility, the intelligence need not be human. Lights in the sky could represent beings from any number of intergalactic civilizations, untethered from time and space, visiting our planet as pure consciousness. I have an even more heretical idea. Any light seen in the sky might be the soul, or consciousness, take your pick, of the eyewitness, somehow detached from their own body at the time of the sighting. Numerous ancient traditions teach us that not only do we possess multiple souls, but that they can go wandering of their own volition, particularly during illness or trance, the exact kinds of trances so many UAP witnesses report during contact. If, and it's a colossal-sized if, lights in the sky actually belong to their witnesses, that they are their own souls, then they fall into the category of doubles. While we're most familiar with this idea in the German tradition, where it's called the doppelganger, doubles of the self, like souls as lights, are found in a variety of cultures. Oftentimes, these doubles are death omens. They signify a weakening of the bonds between body and soul that heralds death. And, as luck would have it, many cultures from indigenous America to Western Europe and beyond have long treated anomalous lights as death omens. The same, it seems, might be said for UAP in general, the light in the sky variety in particular. In a 1979 lecture, John Keel said, "In the 1960s, we had a great many sightings directly over funeral homes and mental hospitals. I could never figure that out." Both structured craft and anomalous orbs of light also appear prior to the deaths of some, not all, but some, experiencers. This was the case in the deaths of Elaine Thomas, Ted Owens, and the tragic passing of contactee Howard Menger's young son. Ideas connecting flying saucers and the human dead were even proposed at one point by Kenneth Arnold, alongside scores of figures from the earliest days of ufology, from researchers to the contactees themselves. Truth be told, most of ufology's early years were a spiritual pursuit rather than a scientific one. Connections to death represent the discipline's Prisca Theologia, or Prisca Ufologia, as I deem it. That's a really funny joke if you're into the academy. Thank you, okay, there we go. Yeah, right? Naturally, the questions arise. What about structured craft? How do they relate to death? I always think that the Keksberg UFO acorn looks kind of like a poop emoji, but that's just me. To plot a crude map of this particular rabbit hole, consider how that many UAP shapes have connections to both death and funerary symbolism. I already mentioned how Jung perceived the flying saucer, and by extension, any circular or spherical craft, as a symbol of totality, e.g. the human self. At the time he made this claim, the other shape, most commonly reported, was that of the cylinder or cigar. Imagining the classic rocket ship image, tip pointed skyward, flames below, we see a torch upside down. Cemetery iconographer expert Douglas Keister wrote, "The inverted torch is a purely funerary symbol. It is unlikely that it will be found anywhere but the cemetery," or we might add, UFO sightings. This is really just one example. We could perform this sort of analysis on all variety of UFO shapes.
We'll be right back after this quick break.
Feel the pulse of the city. Feel the beat of the drum. Feel the bass blow your hair. In Las Vegas, live music delivers much more than sound. It's where music comes alive. With artists like Megan Thee Stallion, Maroon 5, Carrie Underwood, Shania Twain, Babyface, Lionel Richie, and many more. Every show is a playground for your senses. See the full summer lineup at visitlasvegas.com.
Rack up the deals on everything summer at Nordstrom Rack and get brands you love up to 60% off. Vince, Kate Spade New York, Steve Madden, Madewell, Nike, and more.
Great brands, great prices every day at Nordstrom Rack. Just in dresses, tops, shorts, sandals, sneakers, denim, luxury bags, and sunglasses. Rack up the deals today and save up to 60% on summer at your Nordstrom Rack store.
Introducing the new Starbucks Pairings menu, where you can get a tall brewed coffee or tea, hot or iced, paired with a croissant starting at $5, or with a breakfast sandwich starting at $6. Because at Starbucks, we know that some things are better together. Limited time offer at participating stores. Restrictions apply. Visit starbucks.com/pairings to learn more.
This Black Music Month, State Farm wants to take a moment to appreciate all the ways Black music brings everyone together. From the Saturday morning soundtrack that gets the whole family cleaning the house, to the beats at the block parties that bring the whole community together. Celebrate the impact of Black music this month and beyond with State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Perhaps the most interesting idea to me is the possibility that the UFO is a reinvention of a truly ancient archetype, the Psychopomp's boat. To explain this concept requires a bit of background. Psychopomps are cultural figures that lead the dead to the afterlife. The most famous of these are deities like Egypt's Anubis or Greece's Hermes. Lesser known but equally important are folk figures like the Grim Reaper, high-ranking members of society like ancestors or shamans, and natural phenomena like the sun, moon, or aurora borealis, all of which feature extensively in UFO reports. Perhaps the only truly universal psychopomps, however, are animals, specifically the ones that scholar Mircea Eliade deemed shamanic animals par excellence. We're talking about dogs, horses, and birds, especially owls, which seem to have something to do with the UAP phenomenon, as examined extensively by my friend Mike Cleland. The similarities actually don't end there, although they do fall outside the scope of this discussion today. UFO occupants often exhibit the qualities of psychopomps, from a preoccupation with the human soul to carrying wands. Notably, many psychopomps, like Hermes, were also tricksters, a characteristic of paranormal phenomena remarked upon at great length by researchers. Alongside these figures, however, one psychopomp symbol reigns supreme, the boat. Many psychopomps embody themes of travel. Think about it, birds, horses, going places human beings can't. Many psychopomps embody themes of travel, capable of carrying the dead to the far-flung reaches of the world where many cultures believe the afterlife or other world was located. Boats were no exception, and they appear, both literally in the form of grave goods and symbolically in the form of effigies and images, in a variety of ancient burials spanning from China to Scandinavia to Egypt and the Americas. In fact, many early cultures repurposed small boats like canoes as caskets. Consider these themes in regard to UAP, which already presents substantial connections to the dead. Ufology is a transportation-obsessed discipline. Where are they from? Where are they going? How do they get here? Where are they taking me? The flying saucer serves the same function as a psychopomp's boat. It transports humans to another world. As with the idea that UFOs might be souls, Carl Jung proposed this idea in the 1950s, writing, "The idea that the UFO might be a sort of Charon is certainly one that I have not met in the literature so far." Charon, of course, being the Greek ferryman who transported the dead across the River Styx. However, as mentioned earlier, we cannot present UAP solely as psychic objects. They clearly have a physical component. This leads us to one startling possibility, that they represent technology created in the afterlife, or another dimension, depending on your preferred nomenclature. The idea of a static afterlife, where technological process never occurs, is primarily a modern concept. Ancient Egyptians, for example, felt that existence in their afterlife, the Tuat, carried with it all the mundane chores of an earthly life, from work to sleep to eating to worship. Which is kind of a bummer when you think about it. Ancient Chinese traditions speak of the afterlife as a mirror image of the empire. complete with the potential for technological developments. In Korean shamanic practice on Jeju Island, the types of offerings accepted by deceased ancestors have changed over the centuries. One shaman told an ethnologist making a subpar donation, "These days, ancestors don't wear such clothing. The ancestors have become refined." The implication is that change and progress are as much a part of the next life as they are a part of this one. As far-fetched as the idea sounds, could UAP represent technology designed and built in the afterlife, piercing the veil into our reality? The notion is surprisingly old in UFO literature. Summarizing a May 8, 1969 lecture delivered by UFO enthusiast Sir Victor Goddard, Charles Bowen wrote, "UFOs may well be the work of departed ones, and that the consciousnesses of the dead can return to display the wonders of the new world in which they find themselves. Could not the consciousnesses of those who had been technically skilled in this present world of ours return to demonstrate, for example, the advanced aerial machines of their new world?" There is so much more to be said on the connections between UAP and death. The presence of death encompasses nearly every fringe topic. Alien abductions, fairy folklore, and near-death experiences, of course, but also spirituality, shamanism, altered states of consciousness, even ley lines, cryptids, and ancient monuments. Every step of the way, I've found that our final transition is influencing our beliefs and superstitions. Beliefs and superstitions that seem grounded within inescapable truths. Writing Ecology of Souls was a journey, and once I reached my destination, I found my perspective on the phenomenon fundamentally changed. I realized that these are radical ideas. They position the UFO as a confrontation to our spirituality in the same way that it represents an obvious confrontation to our science. To summarize minds brighter than my own, perhaps that's the purpose behind UAP, to confront everything we know about reality, from the physical to the non-physical, to confront our beliefs, to confront ourselves. I am not certain that any of these ideas are accurate. You don't have to be either. What they are, however, is another way of thinking about these topics that rarely finds its way to events like this. For that, I would like to extend a sincere thank you to Jay, James, and Leslie, as well as all of you, for letting me speak today. A special thanks also to my wife, Sarah. Those of you here today are seeing something even rarer than a UAP, my wife at a UFO event. I'd also be remiss to not acknowledge my mentor, Greg Bishop. If I hadn't started listening to Radio Misterioso all those years ago, I probably wouldn't be up here either. So thank you, Greg. I'll leave you the same questions that have lingered in my mind ever since finishing Ecology of Souls. Would you even know what to do with these connections, should they prove to be true? What do they say about your place in the universe? And most importantly, what do they say about the way you treat other living beings on this isolated island in the cosmos? Thank you, everyone.
All right.
Guess what? It's time for Q&A. We've got time for Q&A. We've got almost a half hour for Q&A. So
give us all your best questions. And we'll start with Science Bob McGuire, since it's right here.
Thank you. Joshua, have you entertained the notion that consciousness is fundamental and that there's a universal consciousness in this theory, and all of these things and all of our reality are a projection from the universal consciousness?
So more of an idealist perspective in that sense. I mean, yeah, I think that I am always a little bit out of my depth when the topics about the fundamental nature of reality come into the discussion. I sympathize with notions like that of idealism, but I don't necessarily have enough of a background to address the most common arguments against it. You know, what I will say is that I'm much more sympathetic to that than I am to the idea of simulation theory in the way that it's presented in pop culture, right? I like the idea of simulation theory in the sense that everything is of a piece and that sort of monist idea. But the idea that it's that we're literally plugged into a video game, I think is a little bit too 1990s film version for me. I mean, if we are speculating on the idea of a reality that's above our own, then it should be so foreign and alien to us that we have no idea what that technology, if there's technology involved, represents. So, but yes, I do think that the more you look at this sort of literature, the more it does look as if there isn't really that much of a distinction between these things. I mean, you have entities during these encounters saying things like, it's the me within thee, or, you know, you and I are one, that really sort of hammering home that idea of monism that sort of is a hallmark of a lot of the CE4s. Yeah, thank you.
Let's go with Andrea. Can you pass it back?
Thank you so much. Hi. Joshua. My question is, if you have any thoughts, feelings, concerns about the kind of cultural and technological aspiration, or maybe just expectation that we cure death one day, become post-biological, how does that trajectory, if that's in fact what we're on, play into your thinking?
I mean, I think that if you sort of transpose that as a metaphor, I think we're already doing that in a different aspect of our lives. I mean, there's a certain state of arrested development that I think a lot of ourselves are caught in. You know, I mean, the fact that the phrase I'm adulting has become something that we talk about is a little bit distasteful to me. And I think that it's this same impulse that is to withhold the natural progress of what it means to be a living embodied soul on earth, you know. So going back to the example of adulting, like, you know, yes, you did have to clean your house and pay your rent, but you got to clean your house and pay your rent. You know, you got to do some of these things. And I'm not necessarily making a commentary on whether or not some people actually have a hard time doing that. But what I'm saying is that there is a natural progression to accepting the responsibilities or accepting with dignity the next phase of your life. So similarly, you know, we tend to view death as this horrific thing. But if you look at, you know, when I take my kids to the pediatrician, they also view that as a horrific thing, and it's for their own good. You know, it's going to ensure that they actually have a healthy life. So I think that sort of death is too big of a question with too many missing answers for us to try to hold it off. I think that's unwise in a lot of ways. So it's good to see y'all's faces, by the way.
I've got a fun one from the chat. This is from Sean. As far as experiences go, it seems to be highly individuated. Could our own future self / after death be responsible for each of our own experiences with help of other quote unquote souls?
That seems like it might be a question for Dr. Mike too. This something else. So even though this particular talk just focused on one hyper-focused aspect that I've looked at in terms of the craft shapes and whatnot, the problem with addressing something like death in regards to, you know, UAP is that you end up sort of having to broaden and broaden and broaden your horizons until you're talking about a lot of things that you wouldn't think that you would talk about. And the idea of, you know, I used to be really resistant to the idea that somehow these things were being projected by us or that they were a part of us, because my inner 12-year-old wants there to be monsters and aliens and things like that. But if you do look at the literature, there does seem to be an aspect of this that would, at the very least, if not endorsing, you know, a time travel hypothesis, would sort of point to the idea of something that we would be more comfortable calling a higher self, you know, or an aspect of the self. I mean, that's, I alluded to it briefly in the discussion, but if you look at Egyptian mythology, at one point, it varied between the different dynasties, but at one point there was the assertion that we had 9 different aspects of the soul. You know, certain Scandinavian mythologies posited 3 or more, I think. So there do seem to be these aspects of ourselves that can detach. I mean, this is probably where a lot of these witches' Sabbath motifs come from and werewolf stories come from, this idea that a part of yourself is leaving. So if that's possible, then it seems like, yeah, I mean, if you meet these things and they have this intimate knowledge of you and they seem to be extremely invested in your own future, then maybe they are coming from you in some form or fashion. Doesn't mean it's in your head. It means it's from your head. It doesn't mean it's in your head. I'll make a distinction there.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Feel the pulse of the city. Feel the beat of the drum. Feel the bass blow your hair. In Las Vegas, live music delivers much more than sound. It's where music comes alive. With artists like Megan Thee Stallion, Maroon 5, Carrie Underwood, Shania Twain, Babyface, Lionel Richie, and many more. Every show is a playground for your senses. See the full summer lineup at visitlasvegas.com.
Rack up the deals on everything summer at Nordstrom Rack and get brands you love up to 60% off. Vince, Kate Spade New York, Steve Madden, Madewell, Nike, and more. Great brands, great prices every day at Nordstrom Rack. Just in dresses, tops, shorts, sandals, sneakers, denim, luxury bags, and sunglasses. Rack up the deals today and save up to 60% on summer at your Nordstrom Rack store.
Introducing the new Starbucks Pairings menu, where you can get a tall brewed coffee or tea, hot or iced, paired with a croissant starting at $5, or with a breakfast sandwich starting at $6. Because at Starbucks, we know that some things are better together. Limited time offer at participating stores. Restrictions apply. Visit starbucks.com/pairings to learn more.
Do you know about all the musical genres that were created by Black musicians? Like jazz, rock and roll, and folk music, to name a few. This Black Music Month, State Farm is celebrating the cultural impact and influence of music created and inspired by Black innovators. Next time you're enjoying a song, trace it back to its origins and see for yourself. Check out the Black Music Forever station on Pandora, brought to you by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
All right. Did you have a question? Okay. We'll go with you, then we'll go to the chat, and then we'll go to Courtney.
All right. I'll take it. Hey, thank you. So I have just no issue whatsoever with a non-scientific methodology, but I do wonder if you could, you know, preserve the heart of this way of studying things and still maybe borrow some of the useful aspects. And I guess I'm referring specifically to the idea of, like, standardizing reporting, like, mm-hmm. in the sense that there are better and worse ways to report on these things, and there yes. could be some, because right now it just seems to be like, you know, three or four, you know, sentences uploaded to MUFON or some database yeah. or something. And, it, and I know that there is structure there, but is there, you know, when you think about like the way that like forensic psychologists look at something, that's a non-scientific study that is highly idiosyncratic, but there are better and worse ways to do it.
Right.
And is there any possibility or anything you know of that's going on like that in this world, including going forward and also including like a retroactive structuring of obviously thousands of years of collection? Thank you.
No, that's a great question. And my mind is going in so many different directions. I mean, as you alluded to, there are things that we deal with which we primarily know from anecdotal evidence. I mean, a lot of the conditions in the DSM are from the actual experience of the person who's suffering from these conditions. So, and yeah, there's a real problem with verification and people standing beside what they've said. And it's only gotten worse with the internet because the vectors for sharing this have become places like YouTube and Reddit, which, you know, it's a minefield, right? What I tend to look for is just sort of the gestalt of what people are saying. So when I find someone in, you know, Casey, Iowa, who's saying something that I also read in a Mesopotamian text from, you know, several millennia ago, then that's when I go, well, maybe there's something, you know, some sort of connective tissue here. I do think that I'm of two minds about this. I think that there do need to be more rigorous efforts to maintain databases and data collection of this. But I am also of the opinion personally, that's a goal to aspire to, right? But I'm of the opinion personally that the phenomena doesn't like that. I think that there is something about these phenomena in general, and I cast a very broad net when I say that, that really loves being thriving in this zone of doubt. It's almost like the pH in the water for certain organisms. Like there has to be a certain threshold of doubt pH for these things to really thrive. This is inspired mostly by the work of George P. Hansen and his book, Trickster and the Paranormal. And I know that, you know, I know that I'm completely aware that that sounds like an excuse. I guess my interest in these topics has never really solely lied in, you know, the binary of proving whether or not they do or don't exist. I find the effects on the witnesses to be a lot more interesting, and the way that they sort of nest into our existing mythologies while also taking everything from our mythologies and piling them into one new basket. You know, there are efforts that will continue to be efforts. I think that the efforts to catalog this are I see the best efforts that I have in a long time, because a lot of these larger organizations have, quite frankly, failed us in terms of the way that they, not only the way that they collect information, but the biases that they come into it with. And also the fact that they just don't do anything with a lot of this information. You know, it sits in a database somewhere, it goes into a file. So I hope that is something of a roundabout answer to your question.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks very much. Our next question is from the live stream. It's from Kit Vack. From Kit, have you had your own personal UFO or paranormal experience that you feel comfortable sharing?
I've had a couple of things. You could probably fit them inside a thimble, as I like to say. But I did have an experience of touring a building that was used in the American Civil War as a hospital. And the staircase to get to the second floor was quite narrow. It's almost as narrow as the hallways in the hotel where we're staying. Real narrow. But it was narrow enough to preclude anyone, you know, any two groups coming using the stairway at the same time. So a group would stay at the top of the stairs while one group filed their way up, and then once they were up, the group that was upstairs waiting would come down. And I got to the top of the stairs, and the group that was waiting to come down included a young man in a Civil War uniform. I can still see his face to this day. He was a little bit taller, probably about 14 or 15, a tallish 14 or 15 year old. And he looked at me with these sunken eyes, and I was like, cool, he's cosplaying. You know, I didn't really think anything of it. And then I talked to my mother and some of the other folks on the tour, and they didn't see anybody. And I talked to the people who were running admission, who served as the, you know, de facto gatekeepers for that particular site, and nobody had come through there. So maybe he changed in another room, or maybe I saw a ghost, you know, I don't know. I do have a fun Sasquatch adjacent honeymoon story. So in lieu of an exotic honeymoon, we actually went to the mountains of North Georgia, to Blue Ridge, and we got a cabin. And the cabin overlooked a valley, and there was a hot tub on the back deck. And I was being a drunken idiot, and I was into these topics, but I wasn't, you know, active in these topics. And so I was doing the characteristic Bigfoot whoops and stuff like that, which I won't regale you with now, but... Anyway, I didn't think anything of it. I was just having a laugh. And then the next day, we're starting to take stuff out of the car, and my wife takes the first load, and she goes, why'd you do that? I said, why'd I do what? She's like, why'd you put that rock behind the car? I'm like, what are you talking about? And I go back, and behind, I believe it was the rear driver's side tire, there was a rock about the size of a basketball that was basically wedged behind the tire. And this cabin was at the top of a driveway that was probably... It was at least a quarter of a mile up. I don't want to say it was a 45 degree angle, but it was really quite steep. And I'm like, if you're gonna play a prank, that's kind of a weak prank to play. I'm just gonna wedge this rock behind his tire. And I don't know how it got there. It didn't really correspond to any of the rocks that were around us. All the rocks in the sort of driveway were just pieces of gravel. And there was a hillside that it presumably could have come from, but all that hillside, all those rocks were covered in red Georgia clay. So I don't know if I had a Bigfoot honeymoon visitation, but I love that phrase, so.
Me too, that's fantastic. Okay, we'll go with Courtney next. Courtney?
Thank you. Hi, Joshua, thank you. Hi. For your excellent presentation.
Thank you.
So much is swimming through my mind about your work, but one thing stood out particularly, and I'm just curious, when you're talking about the double, mm-hmm. One of the things that I think might be a tie-in, which you may or may not know about, is Jacob Moreno's work. He worked here in New York, and he did psychodrama. It was an expressive art therapy. And one of the methods was a double, where you concretize through a dramatic space a double, yourself and another actor who's working through this double persona. And so I'm just wondering if you ever heard about his work. And the second question about the double is, are you seeing anything modern work from psychology or in healing modalities that is actually concretizing the mandala, like in this other artistic expressive healing format, where you're concretizing these type of esoteric concepts through the mandala for any healing psychologically or in psychiatry?
So to your first point, I had not heard of that, but that sounds like it's a fascinating marriage of, you know, sort of coming to grips with the shadow self and integrating in that capacity. So I'll have to look into that. That sounds really interesting. In terms of the application as sort of the mandala as this sort of holistic healing apparatus, I've been involved in the recovery community for about 3 years now, and I have noticed a real It seems as if the image of the mandala has become quite ubiquitous. There are some, interestingly enough, there is a recovery center that's near a research site that I am interested in that includes a medicine wheel. And obviously a medicine wheel isn't a mandala, but I would argue that it's sort of speaking to the same sort of motifs. And also I know that there have been a lot of people in the recovery community who have started using the creation of mandalas in various artwork settings to sort of foster a sense of peace. So that's the primary places that I'm aware of it being used right now. But yeah, that's interesting.
Let's see. Okay, we'll go with Craig Bishop next. And then I promise we'll get back to you guys in the back.
Thank you. Hey, Josh, I think we've talked about this, but do you see any way of getting to the root of the UFO thing as the thing in itself and not through metaphor and all that? And is there any way we can do that without going through our own language and metaphors?
I mean, so yeah, my favorite meme that I think I've ever seen is this picture of a gentleman at the beach and the tide is coming in, the tide is labeled reality, and he's hammering nails into it and the nails say language. I think that's a pretty accurate description of pretty much everything that we're doing. I mean, I realize this might not be a popular opinion, but I really don't think we can get to the root of it. And even though I've been convinced of the parsimony of this idea connecting it somehow to the dead for a while, I really hope that even I don't stay on that for a while. And to me, like, that's what the UFO has been, is it's shifted and been a co-traveler on a journey of really, quite frankly, self-exploration. And that's part of the reason that I wonder if it's not, an interest in the UFO isn't just an alchemical journey in and of itself. Like, it really has re-enchanted it's re-enchanted my world. Like, we took the boys, I have twins. We took them to a children's science museum, and I found myself standing in front of like a geology exhibit. And if you like geology, more power to you, but I really don't have much of an interest in it. But I'm staring at the geology exhibit, and I made like a 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon kind of jump to UFOs while I'm staring at the geology exhibit. I'm like, oh, now I'm interested in this again. So it really has it's been a journey of like personal development, personal work. And it reminds me of that famous Ami Michel quote where he said, when you engage in the topic of studying flying saucers, you start out with field work and you end up reading the writings of obscure Arab mystics, is what he said, I believe, in that quote. But as far as it's getting to like the ontological definite of what the UFO is, I just, in my experience working with people, it's a bit like a watermelon seed where if you try to grab it, it just shoots off if you put too much pressure on it. Now, I think something is objectively going on, but I'm not certain that it doesn't mean certain things to certain people, depending upon their needs, quite frankly. Yeah, great. Rorschach plot, yeah.
Thank you so much. Wonderful. Another question from the live stream from Marilyn. Did your research carry you into the study of the astral realm? And if so, how did that resolve in your thoughts?
A little bit. And it sort of led me to a bit of a contentious stance on what we would refer to as alien abduction. I'm not convinced that a vast majority of those things don't unfold in something like an astral realm. Obviously, there are going to be some caveats to that. You do have these cases where cars are taken extensive distances. But even in those examples, there was an example that I found from the 1950s, back when we were still calling the country Rhodesia, of a couple that was transported, their car was transported a vast distance during this, UFO contact experience. But even in that contact experience, the driver of the car, the husband, was saying, it was a bit like when I astro travel, is what he said in that particular quote. And I'm like, okay, so he's like, they went on a dead straight line, which is another theme that you see in regards not only to ley lines, but also these death roads and things like that in the work of Paul Devereux. So I am, to a certain degree, personally, I'm not asking anybody else to feel this way, but I am personally convinced that a lot of these experiences do take place in some sort of altered state of consciousness, which is probably why we see such a high incidence with examples of, road hypnosis and being on the verge of sleep, hypnagogia, hypnopompia. But again, as I alluded to earlier, just because it unfolds in that realm doesn't mean that it doesn't have repercussions to our physical bodies. I mean, quite often in some of these older werewolf legends that you would find from the Middle Ages, people would be known because an injury inflicted on the wolf, not necessarily a wolf man, but the wolf, would manifest on the body of the person of the suspected werewolf. And, you know, in our modern thinking, we're like, oh, he literally transformed into a werewolf and the werewolf got shot and the wound didn't heal when he transformed back into a human. But another way of thinking is that the astral zoomorphic form was actually wounded and manifested a wound on the person's body. If anybody's interested in that, the work of Claude Lecuteau is a great resource for some of those stories.
All right, and questions from the back.
Thank you, Joshua. Great talk.
Thank you.
This question is about size and scale. So in your premise, if we are kind of putting that out there that light is potentially a representation of the soul's journey, what would it mean then if we're potentially seeing and interacting with these giant objects in the sky? Would that be a giant collection of souls and possibly, or what do you make of that?
I mean, your guess is as good as mine. I think that if you went back and sort of took a look at a lot of New Age teachings and spiritualist teachings, you could probably find an allusion to certain qualities of lights being ascribed to people who had accomplished certain deeds or were more enlightened, perhaps something along those lines. I think the work of Emanuel Swedenborg is really interesting in this regard because he was talking about these beings from other planets being, you know, primarily in the form of light. But, you know, in terms of size, maybe things like size or color are indications of the source of it being from human or non-human sources. And, you know, quite frankly, by non-human, I don't necessarily even just mean extraterrestrials. I mean mountains and elephants and all these things, you know, any number of things. If we really are dealing with, again, an ecology of souls with different niches to fulfill. But as far as like me being able to like put a pin in exactly what that means and what exactly that indicates, I don't know. Most of the time when you read these stories about the soul as an orb of light, they tend to be small. And in my experience, speaking to eyewitnesses who see orbs of light, they'll range between basketball sized and ping pong ball sized. And quite frankly, the work of my friend Massimo Teodorani and his wife Susan Demeter do point to the fact that we might be dealing with something substantively different than my idea of human souls as well. So I'm leaving that open to interpretation entirely. Great question, though.
Totally agreed. Why don't we take one more from towards the back?
So you had mentioned that your research into death has changed your views of how you think of the UFO. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm wondering, I'm curious how it's also changed your view of the afterlife and your spirituality, if at all, your actions here and now.
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. I often joke that if you read Ecology of Souls, it's like, you know, there's the two books, which really it's one book because I had split it in two because it was going to be too big. But like there's that text, and then there's also this sort of third book hidden in between the lines, which is me just like trying to integrate this stuff. I grew up Christian and I still am a Christian. And some of these ideas, I know that there are people in the Christian church who would say that I'm a heretic for even indulging in some of these ideas. So I did write an afterword, which is just me being personal about trying to sort of pull these things apart. There was something that I read one time that really, really sort of bothered me because they were talking about all the similarities between Christ's life and Osiris and, you know, Odin being hung on the tree and things like that. And they said, well, you know, a true story doesn't appear everywhere. I'm like, yeah, but the truest story, the archetypal story, does appear everywhere. And that's sort of where I've sort of fallen in line with, is that we are seeing these archetypes. And in my estimation, personally, the way that I make it work in my life is that these archetypes are kind of the source code of the universe, and they're these things that we keep returning to, and these trajectories that a lot of our lives and a lot of our journeys keep coming back to time and time again. So I sort of have set up this cognitive, I've learned to live with the cognitive dissonance in my head, I guess is the best way of putting it, of my own personal faith while also trying to look at this as well. For me, though, I don't really see that much of a contradiction. To me, everything I talk about in the Ecology of Souls is looking at how a watch works. If we're looking at, you know, the phenomenon of the universe, like I'm looking at how the watch works, that doesn't make me more punctual. It doesn't make me understand time. You know, it doesn't make me more mindful about time. But so I kind of separate those two things in my own personal life. But that's a great question. And that was a very personal experience for me, for sure.
Thank you so much. Another question from the live stream from Dan. How do recent revelations of aerospace companies potentially obtaining UAP craft make you feel about us solving the UAP mystery?
Oh boy. You know, I don't think it's too much of a secret to say that historically I've been pretty critical of the whole disclosure movement. Not because, I mean, I've shifted my opinion to a degree, and I'll get to that in a moment if I have enough time. But I just, I have seen so much of this high strangeness be swept under the rug in terms of the pop culture discourse. And for the longest time, I was sort of operating under the belief that that was the sole goal of the disclosure movement. So, you know, under that metric, I was really sort of critical of the idea that we would ever achieve anything resembling that. I've come around to the idea that this has to be revealed slowly but surely. I personally feel that this phenomenon, even if it's not, even if this book is full of data pareidolia, right? Even if I'm getting everything wrong, there's still something really strange, fundamentally reality bending about the UFO experience. And maybe we can separate some of the lights in the sky from that. Maybe we can separate some of the structure craft from that. But when you get into the terms of the effect that it has on experiencers, there is something fundamentally strange, and I would argue metaphysical about it. And I am cynical about that ever being addressed by authority structures, because in some ways I feel like it undermines their ability to control human beings. But at the same time, I realize that you can't even begin to have that conversation until you acknowledge the fact that there is something going on. So my current hopes for this disclosure season will be something resembling where the public has landed on the JFK assassination, which, you know, nobody, very few people on the street will say, I think X, Y, Z killed Kennedy. But pretty much now, in a contrast to maybe even as recently as 20 or 30 years ago, pretty much now everyone's like, yeah, something was going on. Something was strange. And that's sort of my hopes. And if that can be what we get out of this current round of disclosure, then I think that's good, that people don't necessarily say, well, it's, you know, the Zoltarian Alliance from Zebul Ghanoubi. Like, if they say, I don't know what's going on, but something strange is going on, then quite frankly, that is a win. So that's how I've come around to the topic.
All right. Thank you so much. That's our time with Joshua Cutchin.
To take a minute to thank you for listening. This podcast is truly a labor of love. I do my best with every single episode to bring you content that you can't find anywhere else, from meticulously researched deep dives to probing conversations with top experts in the field. If you're enjoying the podcast, I hope you'll consider supporting this work by becoming a patron. Patrons get access to new episodes before anyone else, as well as access to the ad-free version of the podcast. We also have twice monthly Zoom calls where you can ask me questions, share your own work, and meet other people in the community. Patrons also get access to the private UFO Rabbit Hole Discord server, which is a thriving community that hosts book clubs, happy hours, and more. Memberships start at just $5 a month, or pay annually and save 15%. Sign up now at patreon.com/UFO Rabbit Hole. You can find the link in the episode description.
Feel the pulse of the city. Feel the beat of the drum. Feel the bass blow your hair. In Las Vegas, live music delivers much more than sound. It's where music comes alive. With artists like Megan Thee Stallion, Maroon 5, Carrie Underwood, Shania Twain, Babyface, Lionel Richie, and many more. Every show is a playground for your senses. See the full summer lineup at visitlasvegas.com.
Rack up the deals on everything summer at Nordstrom Rack and get brands you love up to 60% off. Vince, Kate Spade New York, Steve Madden, Madewell, Nike, and more. Great brands, great prices every day at Nordstrom Rack. Just in dresses, tops, shorts, sandals, sneakers, denim, luxury bags, and sunglasses.
Rack up the deals today and save up to 60% on summer at your Nordstrom Rack store.
Do you know about all the musical genres that were created by Black musicians? Like jazz, rock and roll, and folk music, to name a few. This Black Music Month, State Farm is celebrating the cultural impact and influence of music created and inspired by Black innovators. Next time you're enjoying a song, trace it back to its origins and see for yourself. Check out the Black Music Forever station on Pandora, brought to you by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.